case number four, and that is 02-3198, Theodore Roxburgh versus Emeritech Corporation. And good morning, Mr. Parris.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Tom Parris for Theodore Roxburgh. If your docket was dull, I know this one picked it up a little bit. There's many issues, but where I want to start is just the phrase confidential, which is in this agreement that the parties have signed. What is this confidential information? It's not defined within the agreement. It's not really defined within Judge Hagel's opinion. The party's intent is what should control here. Certainly Theodore Roxburgh thought it was confidential. He acted like that from day one when he called Emeritech and told him he had some prospective company that wanted to be to want. The fax cover sheet that he received from BCE says it was confidential.
But fax cover sheets always say that. I mean, I was really flabbergasted, in fact, that you are relying in part on a fax cover sheet, which looks to me like every fax cover sheet I've ever seen, practically, as well as the little tags on emails you get from law firms. What evidence, what concrete evidence is there in this record that Mr. Roxburgh had anything that was not in the public domain?
He had a couple letters, at a minimum, two letters, which Howard Hendricks sent him that had the signature of the CEO of Bell Canada on them. Those letters indicated that BCE was willing to meet with a prospective buyer to sell 20% of its company, one out of every five shares for a price.
Why is that confidential information as opposed to a promise of a future meeting at which there could be a conversation about whether somebody has... Where is the evidence of something, anything, that's not in the public domain?
One could, just in terms of whether that's confidential, would someone consider that material? I don't think we need to get to a SEC definition.
No, I'm not an SEC definition either, but a letter talking about a meeting doesn't tell me anything about what Mr. Roxburgh had in his possession that was confidential information that might have been of interest to a prospective, somebody in a prospective transaction.
I submit that knowledge and a letter, an invitation, indicating that 20% of this company is for sale to for the proper price, is confidential. Whether the two CEOs are exchanging that information, as they apparently later did, over the phone or in some meeting, or whether Theodore Roxburgh has it, it's information that's valuable. It's the kind of information, as I've shown in these cases that I've cited with respect to a finder's fee, that is valuable confidential information, an introduction between two willing parties.
Well, of course, the express language of the agreement anticipates a subsequent disclosure of confidential information. It says nothing whatsoever about information that has already been disclosed. And the agreement also says that it replaces all prior agreements between the parties. So if Mr. Roxburgh had already disclosed everything to Emeritech, isn't he like out of luck here?
I think that it's really a contemporaneous exchange. Dan Foreman certainly is not expecting any more information. I asked him why, on page 10 of my reply brief, did you tell Mr. Roxburgh that you wouldn't sign the agreement until he provided additional information about the project? That's because first there's this phone call following up on just a fact saying I have some companies that may be interested in being purchased. Let's see, I don't know if I specifically said that, but that is, you know, I think we went over that earlier. We typically would want to know who the company is before we proceed to buy them. So there's this contemporaneous exchange, I think, is what happens here. And
that's not what the agreement says.
Right.
Business people are stuck, as it were, with the terms of what they write down in agreements. And this September 12, 1996 agreement is quite clear that the word will immediately disclose that future events will happen, and if the parties signed the wrong agreement, that's their problem. There's no agreement to do anything else.
I think the key is when you indicate that this is a couple business people, if you will, who are creating this contract that has perhaps some ambiguity in what is
but
being exchanged.
That's what I'm saying. There's no ambiguity that I see. Of course, that's a question of law for this court to decide. But this agreement doesn't say anything about prior consideration. It doesn't say anything about this is contemporaneous with giving you information. This is an agreement to give future confidential information to Ameritech.
And I believe if you read in context what the two people who exchanged this information had to say about how
that doesn't matter if it says this agreement replaces any and all other agreements. That language is used, as you well know, to precisely to avoid the need to track down every conversation people ever had, every scrap of paper they ever signed before that date.
There are no prior agreements between the parties that have been.
Well, there may be or there may not be, but they're irrelevant if there are any. And so there is no context other than the agreement itself.
Well, respectfully, I disagree in terms of looking at what the parties did and how this came about. Why Dan Foreman would sign such an agreement obligating his company potentially to $2.5 million without something. And he indicates in his testimony that before I sign these things, I want to know who the company is. Roxford discloses that information to him, sends his analysis, sends these two BCE letters and perhaps other stuff that has been.
But why wouldn't he sign it? He has signed something that says if Vakil discloses confidential information and if the deal goes through, then the money will get paid. But the converse of those propositions is if there's no confidential information or the deal never happens, no money has to get paid. What's to deter him from exploring a possibility? I mean, if your client never gave any confidential information after the date of this agreement, then Ameritech's not bound to do a single thing.
I address that further with respect to whether the resubmission of this information, the originals, had any value. And you'll see that I have put in the short appendix a letter which my client had from T. Blue Pickens.
Why would the fact that he waited to send the originals matter at all? By sending copies of the letter to Ameritech back in August, he had already disclosed the information contained in the letters. What in the world could Ameritech do with originals that it couldn't already do with the fax copies?
The same thing that T. Blue Pickens did years earlier when he paid my client $500,000 for those originals. And if you read that contract closely, it says, in consideration, that is, my client would have breached the agreement had he not turned over those originals. What value is it? It keeps it out of the hands of Ameritech's competitors, for one, which is a detriment to my client. Two, it keeps my client from shopping it elsewhere. If he no longer has it, he can't shop it to other potential suitors. Three, if Ameritech doesn't want to do it now, they may be able to do it later, which in fact, a couple years later, they did do.
But that doesn't go to whether Ameritech had learned something new from the originals. It certainly, I mean, you raise plausible reasons why Ameritech might like to have them, but it doesn't learn anything new in a substantive sense about the potential investor, about the deal, about anything.
It may not learn anything new, but it has something.
And that's the point. Where's the new confidential information? Where is the new confidential information referred to in the opening paragraph of the agreement? It's not new confidential information if it's just tidying up the files so that it doesn't leak out elsewhere. Sort of leaked to you, maybe, but that's not what this agreement's about.
My point about him producing the originals is that it does not produce new information. What it does, it is consideration in terms of it has value to Ameritech, or at least potential value to them, and a detriment to my client.
But it's not performance of this agreement. It might be something else.
Well, if there is performance, it's because there's confidential at the outset. And I'd like to reserve.
Do you want to comment before you sit down about the assertion that this is all just some con and.
Respectfully, Your Honor, if you believe that Theodore Roxford is a con man, I think you necessarily have to go along with the rest of his testimony and not pick one place or the other. There is no proof outside of his testimony as to any kind. There's not an indictment, there's not an arrest, there's not an allegation pending ever anywhere. And so to pick out and say, well, he's a con man, we agree and we believe his testimony there, but we think he's lying as to what he produced and what was confidential and what he had, I don't think at this stage in litigation you can. Could a jury do that later? I think they'd be free to do so, but not at the summary judgment level.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Parris. Rich Nutt?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Craig Nutt. My colleague Al Hogan and I are here on behalf of Meritech Corporation this morning asking that you affirm the District Court's grant of summary judgment. Summary judgment was appropriate in this case for two reasons. First of all, the undisputed testimony, all of the evidence, most of it from Mr. Rockford himself, indicates that to the extent he ever had anything at all, to the extent he was not a con man, he turned all of that over 3 weeks before there was any contract. And his evidence further shows that he merely resent that same information after the September 12, 1996 agreement has been entered into. In the agreement, he promised that he would immediately disclose confidential information. Instead, he resent the same materials that he had sent before.
If after the agreement was signed, he sent the originals of whatever information he had disclosed to Ameritech previously, could that re-performance suffice to bind Ameritech to the agreement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and the reason is in the contract, Mr. Rockford promised that he would disclose something, that he would make known something that was not known before. So merely resending didn't do that. And before I move on to my next point, I'd just like to make clear that we know this from his own deposition testimony, from his Rule 56-1 statement, and his brief in this court. There simply is no dispute that he provided the information to the extent he had anything before there was a contract and did not perform afterwards. He merely resent what he had. The second reason summary judgment was appropriate is that there is nothing in this record beyond Mr. Rockford's own uncorroborated testimony that he ever had the letters from the BCE, the Bell Canada executive, that he claimed to.
But that wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
I mean, if you and I had a dispute between us, and I testified that we met this morning at the corner bakery, and you testified that you'd never heard of me or seen me or anything, and certainly were not at the corner bakery with me, that sounds like a disputed issue of fact. We're both competent to testify about whether we were in the corner bakery this morning. And maybe I say we weren't and you say we weren't and nobody is corroborating me, but we have no general rule in a kind of medieval English law of corroboration of witnesses. So I was troubled by that argument of yours, since it's certainly true that four of the executives say they'd never heard of Mr. Rockford, and the fifth one, as we know, is a slightly different case. But if he says one thing and they say the other, don't we at least need to see whether, even taking the facts in the light most favorable to his version, there's any evidence of confidential information?
Two responses, Your Honor. The first is from the Weeks versus Samsung case. Quote, a plaintiff's own uncorroborated testimony is insufficient to defeat a motion for summary judgment.
Let me just stop you, because I know that there are cases from this court saying that. But it's certainly my view that that's been taken out of context. So long as plaintiff has personal knowledge of something, his own affidavit is enough to create a fact question. I'm going to have you take a look at Fisher versus Packer, which is an en banc decision of this court. And it is 924 F. 2nd 655. Judge Posner, writing for the en banc court, explains it very nicely. I won't take up, time here. Mr. Roxburgh would have had personal knowledge of the confidential information in his possession. And if so, then his affidavit and contrary testimony from the other witnesses would present a straightforward credibility contest for a finder of fact.
Your Honor, and I appreciate the cite to that case, and it was certainly something that we had looked at in connection with making that argument. And we weren't relying merely on the Weeks opinion. There were other cases cited in our brief, the Shanks.
I started out by saying to you, I know that there are cases from this court. I know that. They've been taken out of context. So...
I apologize for being roundabout. I think the context comes from, if I could pursue the point further, the concept derived from Celotex and Anderson versus Liberty Lobby that a mere metaphysical dispute is not enough to create a genuine issue of material fact. It needs to be a reasonable one. And in the cases on which we rely, you had a situation, as we had here, where all of the evidence from non-party witnesses, five of them, from a complete lack of documentation from the other side, pointed in one direction, and it was merely the say-so of the other party that went the other way.
Did he ever specify, taking on this half of the case, if you will, the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Roxburgh, did he just say sort of flatly, I had confidential information from these five executives, or did he say I exchanged correspondence with them? I mean, how specifically does he describe what's the content of the confidential information?
Very specifically, Your Honor, and that is the third prong of the reasonableness argument that I was making previously. It's not merely a letter from Mr. Hendrick at Bell Canada saying, I will meet with you to talk about your investor from India who might want to invest in our company. That's what he's saying now. That's not what he said in his deposition, and he cannot create an issue in his own affidavit that is contrary to his deposition. In his deposition, he said very specifically what was at issue. There were two letters he claimed from Mr. Jean Monti, who was the CEO of Nortel. Mr. Roxburgh mistakenly claimed that he was also the president of Bell Canada at the time. He was not. But he described two letters from Mr. Monti, identical letters, but signed in these different capacities, one of which did not even exist at the time. He described, secondly, a letter from Mr. L.R. Wilson, who was the chief executive officer of Bell Canada. Mr. Wilson, he said that was the third letter from the second person. He described another letter from a person who he claimed was the CFO of Bell Canada, Mr. William Anderson. Well, Mr. Anderson was not, in fact, the CFO of Bell Canada. He was working in London for a cable television company at the time. He next cited a letter from an unknown director, and that was about all the identification he could give, other than to say that in this unknown director letter, he CC'd all the other persons that I've mentioned thus far and indicated that he was very interested in Mr. Roxburgh's proposal. And finally, there were two letters from Mr. Hendrick that he claimed, which are different from the letter that he now relies on. We concede that Mr. Hendrick sent a letter to Mr. Roxburgh saying, I would be willing to meet with you to discuss your Indian client's proposal. That's not in dispute. But that's not the letters that Mr. Roxburgh said that he had. He said that he had letters from Mr. Hendrick that enclosed schedules and itineraries that gave his own personal sense of where this deal might go, and then a second letter that talked about the contents of the deal more specifically. So when that fact is taken into account, that is that the letter he's talking about now is different than what he testified at length about in his deposition and is set forth in our brief, that testimony, a summary of it. We believe that his own uncorroborated testimony is not enough in those circumstances. So not only was it the testimony of other witnesses, but the affidavit that he was presenting here was something that was contradictory, that contradicted what he had said in his deposition. And so on that grounds, we submit that his own testimony, his uncorroborated testimony, without something more, was insufficient. In conclusion, I would like to address very briefly the con man point that Judge Evans referred to just a minute ago. The question of Mr. Rochford's status as a con man was an issue in this case. It was not an issue, however, at the summary judgment stage. The decision of Judge Zagel made no mention of it. The briefs that were submitted below referenced it. They submitted the articles that we reproduced in the appendix, but it was not an issue here. And accordingly, I request that you affirm the grant of summary judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knott. Mr. Parrish, I'm going to give you another minute. You used your time, but come on up. If you have anything to add, 1 minute, please.
In reply, what conversation the plaintiff and Dan Foreman had is different than what he testified at his deposition. That is to say that at length, over hours, he was asked, what did you have, you know, and went into this degree. But that's not what he disclosed in this contract. The contract, as you can read, says, I have confidential information. It doesn't say I have 5 letters from various executives who work for this and that company. And that's not, there's no testimony that he indicated all of that to Dan Foreman. And so, and looking at what this contract means, just that confidential information. And as to whether it's confidential, I submit to you that once it became known that Meritech was spending $3.4 billion on this same transaction that Mr. Rochford took, reasonable investors and would have been so had they known that this was being discussed and potentially going to take place, you know, 2 years earlier when Mr. Rochford was involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Thank you to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.